This podcast is brought to you by IFR Magazine. Hi, I'm Jeff Van West for AvWeb and IFR Magazine, and today I'm talking with Del Fadden, the Chief of Flight Deck Technology at Boeing during the development of the 757 and 767. These aircraft were designed at the same time between 1977 and 1982 and certified about 6 months apart in 1982. What was unusual about the aircraft is that they share a common type rating. That is, the pilot trained in one aircraft could legally fly the other one without an additional check ride. Del, how did this come to pass?
It's sort of interesting. All of this came about in a serendipitous way. The way good engineering happens. The two programs are looking for ways of keeping the costs as low as possible for the development. And, of course, the 57 being second had a tougher time getting the resources that they needed. So they were on a thinner shoestring. And at one point, several of us, one was an industrial design guy in my team and one in the flight deck project team in Peter Morton's side, came on the notion of even though these are two very different airplanes, we could make the cockpits identical, and if we did, it would save money for the company in doing the design and development work, because the avionics and the displays and all would be the same. But for the airlines, they could interfly them.
What were some of the biggest and more interesting design challenges you faced trying to get a common cockpit between two significantly different
getting
aircraft?
The equipment common is pretty straightforward, but figuring out what does common mean to the pilots when these airplanes are physically different? You know, one was a narrow body and one was a wide body, and the weights, the masses of the airplanes were quite different, and so things like normal roll rates and acceleration rates would be different between them. We did the flight deck, the way we put the flight deck onto the 57 because of its narrower body, we couldn't do the whole thing. We could only just do the upper third of the outside, and it tilted slightly downward, which gives the 757 that characteristic praying mantis appearance. And that dropped the visibility over the nose by a couple of degrees, making the visibility slightly different for the two. But we compensated for that somewhat by changing the approach attitude, making the approach attitude slightly higher, and so the actual functional vision over the nose was very similar. Not identical, but very similar. And then we get to the issue of handling qualities. How are we going to handle that? And we put some criteria together that still have worked really well. What we said was that the difference between the two airplanes at a proportionate weight, that would be max weight in both or mid weights in both, would be no different than the handling difference between low weight and high weight in either airplane. It presented some problems. They solved them by changing the ailerons on the 7.5 and changing roll rates. That was probably the biggest one. We spent a lot of time on the pitch axis and the pitch trim rate and speed stability and those things to make sure that they hit the criterion that we set out. And it actually worked quite well. It ended up being a good set of criteria that had enough flexibility that the designers could design, and yet we ended up with airplanes that are quite easy to move from one to the other.
You mentioned changing the attitude on landing so that the landing site picture wasn't that
right.
Different between the two airplanes. How did you do that? What does that mean for
in design, all things are changeable if you want them bad enough. So by adjusting the flap, the exact angle of the flap that is going to be the landing flaps, we can change the pitch attitude for the approach speed. We called them the same, but physically on the airplane they weren't the same at all.
Right. So you're telling me that the flat positions, are they by percentage then, or just by position, and they're completely different real-world numbers, but
right.
The pilot thinks of them as the same number?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we set the number scale up so it would be familiar for a commercial airplane pilot, you know, and it goes from zero is up, and then one is leading edges only, and then so on down to 40. And 30 and 40 being the landing flaps, but the number isn't degrees, and it doesn't bear any real relationship to the actual degrees of the flap position. But it is in the proper sequence, and they will reliably stop at each of those positions, and so it works out fine.
Is there anything else in the systems of the plane that is
sure.
similar that way?
The engines were a problem because we had two different engines. One was a pressure ratio controlled engine, and one was an N1 engine. We couldn't change the actual values, you know, to make them the same, because they're representing a totally different parameter and they perform a bit differently. But what we did is take the scale off and gave the pilot the limits and the target. And so the limits and the targets are there, and they dynamically move around the scale. So whatever he's asked to do, whether it's take off or climb or cruise or flight idle, the marker that represents that position is calculated and placed up on the screen on a scale that doesn't have any numbers on it. And he can adjust the pointer using the thrust lever to match that value. And again, the FAA and the pilots were aghast. How can you possibly do this? But if you look at all the tasks that were performed, they really are matching a specific point, then the value is never used. It's just a way of getting to a specific thrust. As long as we can get to the thrust reliably, it didn't make any difference whether it had a value or not. Now, we gave the pilot a readout of the actual value so that they could use it for tracking airplane performance, but it wasn't how the engines were set. They were set using the needle scale against its pointer, and then only if they were doing data taking in flight did they look at the actual number. And there, if you look at all of our airplanes since then, they've all done that on the engine displays there. They don't have numbered scales on them.
What about other aspects of the flight deck that were unique or novel at the time?
Doing the navigation with a map instead of an HSI at the time was seen as a fairly high risk. Now, looking back at it, you know, it really wasn't much of a risk. It was accepted almost immediately, and the guy starts to fly it, and well, of course, this is easy. It's like this all the time. It's just like what's in my head. And that's true. For the guy that is a really good intuitive 3D graphics pilot, he has a similar mental model of the surroundings in his head, and he can use a conventional HSI or even RMIs and CDIs to update that model, and he can fly just about as effectively with or without. But if the pilot's not very graphic, if his mental imagery runs more to text than it does to building mental graphic images, his performance of the map display just went head and shoulders above what he could do with a conventional instrument set. So we're pretty concerned about it. So early in the program, we set up a flight demonstration for our first customer's pilots. We had the Airline Pilots Association pick people. They came out and looked at it all. And there was a lot of comment going into it, and then they came out of the simulator and they talked for a bit, and they said, "Oh, well, that's not an issue."
Right.
Then one guy raised his hands and he said, "I do have one question, though. He said, is this thing going to make me sterile?" Because it was a CRT and it was down between his legs.
And what was your answer?
No, it's not. The energy level for the CRT was below the threshold for X-rays.
Right.
But, you know, it's a good question.
Yeah. Fair enough. Now, I've been in the 6.7 simulator, the level D simulator, and the radios and the glare shield were kind of interesting to me because they seemed to emulate an old school, you know, even like Collins Nav radio. I'm wondering what the story was behind those.
You know, we knew we were putting in the CRT primary displays and the engine displays, and one of the things that several of the senior engineers at Boeing, who were my mentors very early in my career, had said is you need to always remember these guys need a link with the past. So you've got to give them stuff that they know how to work with. You can change some, but you can't change everything.
You have flown a Cirrus as your own personal airplane for years now, Dell. How do you look at the design of the Cirrus cockpit and compare it to that transport category glass cockpit? And is there any space where one can be informed by the other?
Well, yes, I think they are informed, but they are informed at the appearance level and not so much at the performance level. And it's only an unusual company, GA, that will figure out what the performance requirement should be and even pay any attention to it. Mostly they want to make it look snazzy, like the appearance on the big iron. Or they want to make it look different. They want to change symbols in order to make theirs stand out, you know, so that you pick brand A because brand A has this great airplane symbol on it. Well, there wasn't any symbol on the big iron that we hadn't developed a use for the particular shape. Let me give you an example. The airplane symbol on a Boeing display is a isosceles triangle. And it's open, it's not filled in. And the reason for that is that when you're flying right down the center of an airway, the airway line splits that symbol in half. And although you could not necessarily tell how much different the halves are, if they're off by a pixel either way, you know that you're on one side or the other. That was a feature we really wanted to make use of because we wanted him to be able to track the flight plan path really accurately at whatever scale he wanted to use the map. And the reason for scale on the map could be the amount of look ahead or to, you know, see where he's going to get handed off or where the procedure is going to change. And so you want him to have a good look ahead. That makes the scale less sensitive. And yet you want him to have very good sensitivity to fly the path. And we also backed it up with a deviation display that was constant deviation per mile left and right. So he had that as a reference. But most pilots found that they only use the deviation display on final approach and that they up and away the map display with the airplane symbol in that diamond form or the triangular form worked just fine.
Well, back to the GA glass cockpits that you've seen, are there other examples where you think its form is superseding function and making something less useful than it could be?
Yeah, I think back on that same symbol, most avionics manufacturers will put the airplane's position at the centroid of the symbol. So if it happens to be an airplane type symbol across, then the airplane's position is at the intersection of the wings and the body. But that's not where the pilot is. The pilot's in the front. And he needs to know where the front is going. Because if you're in a turn, the front's going to be off the path on the wrong side. So we put the airplane position at the apex of the triangle, not the centroid. And there's no question about where you are and how you'd fly it to stay on a curve.
One of the things that is coming up as an issue more and more, it seems like, in the GA glass cockpit is just information overload. There's many displays, there's so many pieces of information between data link, weather, storm scopes, traffic, terrain, you name it. What, in your opinion, can be done to make that more useful? Because this has been, you know, part of the promise of the safety of technologically advanced aircraft is from all this information, but yet we're not seeing that realized.
Yeah, we characterized that problem on the 5767. We said, you know, on previous airplanes, because of the limitations to what could be displayed on electromechanical instruments, we were always information poor. And the flight deck designer's task was, what can I do with the least possible information? And when with the CRT and the computing display revolution, the problem switched 180 degrees to what in the world am I going to do to manage this deluge of information that will completely swamp it? And I think GA hasn't yet fully come to grips with that. Some people do it better than others, but it isn't. I think it's a blend of automatic moding where information, you know, the airplane is smart enough to know when certain information is important and when it's not, and on the non-important stuff, it's either taken away or it's reduced in prominence in a significant way, and that yet if it becomes important, it comes right back to him without him having to do anything. I think that's one of the requirements for a modern display, that it should adapt itself to the pilot, and the pilot's tasked, and not require the pilot to either adapt to the display or have the pilot adapt the display to himself. It should be an automated function to a very high degree. And that's a tough one, because on the big iron, we do it because we have simulation available a couple of years before we have to freeze the design. And we've been through the task loading, and we know what the pilot's going to do and how he's going to do it, and what's important in this phase, what's important in that phase, and we can tailor the information content to match the task and do it in a way that's inobtrusive. He just says, I don't know why, but everything I need is just there when I need it. And that's what you want. So I think in GA it's going to be a rockier road. I think in the end it'll get to the same place, because the problems with overload are just too severe, and you know, each new design will have to do a bit better at managing overload than the previous one did.
What would that look like in a GA cockpit to manage information better?
Well, the first thing you can do is make the displays as big as you possibly can. You know, if you're designing the airplane from scratch, make maximum use of that display area in front, because you can reduce the information density if the displays are big. And information density is the first big problem. You also make sure the displays are rock solid, so there's no motion associated with any of the symbols that isn't youthful motion. It's truly representing something the airplane's doing. I'm sure you've seen computer graphics where the change in position increments its way along in a ratchety fashion, and it causes everything in the display to move all the time, back and forth by a few bits. And it's terribly distracting, and it's useless. There's nothing good about that.
Right. Now, you still, even though you're retired, you still consult in aviation. What do you think we'll see in the next 5 years or more of cockpit design, both in heavy iron and in light singles?
Well, other than this little economic bump here, if we just ignore that for the time being, I think that the transition to next gen is going to open a lot of change in flight decks on both new and retrofit airplanes to accommodate what's needed to fly in the next-gen environment. If we can do that at a low enough price that it fits the benefits that next-gen offers, then I think that transition will move ahead quickly, because the benefits are pretty big. You know, being able to fly a 3D approach, or even a 3D curved approach, into any airport anywhere in the world without the need for ILS is a big plus. It's so much better doing that, and particularly at night, than it is to try to fly a conventional approach and end up over the airfield at higher than you want to be, and you see it the last minute, and now you're unguided for the last 400 or 500 feet down.
That's a big change of paradigm, though, in how people are used to flying approaches with airlines and regulated training.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you fly them the same way. An RNP is an ILS that has a different shape. If in order to fly a curve, you need to have more data in the nav display so you know that the curve you've got is the right one. Okay, we've been doing that on the Big Iron for a long time, and we put a curve trend out in front of the airplane, and it responds to where the airplane will be 30, 60, and 90 seconds from now, and it does it on a five-second interval, and it provides a good, smooth line to show the path the airplane's going to follow. And if you don't like it, change it. You know, reduce or increase the bank angle, and the turn rate will increase or decrease, and the path over the ground will change. With that, it's really easy to fly curved paths. Now, would you fly that to 100 feet? Yeah, probably not. Not without a flight director, but you can fly it to 200 or 300 feet. 300 feet for sure. And for a lot of GA, getting down to 300 feet on a glide path and on a path that is noise sensitive and terrain sensitive and gets you there in the best possible way, that's a big plus.
But one of the things you just mentioned, Del, though, you talked about flying an approach looking ahead to,
yep,
you know, the trend the airplane will be at in the future. Well, that is the
right
way I would say a lot of GA pilots, in an expert sort of way, fly an approach. I'd say that by far the majority are not flying in a look-ahead kind of way. They're flying in a where-I-am reactive kind of way.
Well, you may think so, but in actual fact, there's a lot of look-ahead information.
Oh, sure.
On those displays, at least the ones that are good, they provide you the instantaneous track angle, you know, where it's going to be, what your reference is going to be, and it's the convergence of those two lines ahead of the airplane that you use to decide when to roll out. If you wait till you see what the airplane's actually doing, it's too late, particularly with a non-inertial GPS airplane. You know, you need to have predictive data up on the screen.
That's a difference in the training paradigm by quite a bit. I mean, I have trouble just because people don't even use their ground track information in order to stay on course. I mean, it's amazing what
right
is overlooked already. So the thought of
right
training people to a
right
3D curve predictively strikes me as a far more daunting task than I think
you need to go fly it.
You're saying.
You need to go fly it, Jeff. It is so easy to fly. I think there has to be a big enough change at this point on the approaches that they're willing to see that there's a benefit. They're not going to change unless there's a benefit. And if curves are how you get in and out, they'll figure out how to do it if that's what they want to do.
Well, we'll agree that the benefit must be large enough to motivate the investment in the equipment and the training to use it. Hopefully the cockpit displays we'll have in GA will be up to the task as well. That's all the time we have today. Thanks for talking to us, Del.
You bet. My pleasure.
This is Jeff Van West for AvWeb and IFR Magazine. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by IFR Magazine. For more on IFR, log on to www.ifr-magazine.com.